Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
But not this book.
No, not so much this book.
In general, yes. In specifics, no, not always.
I love books so much that I'm going to reduce the population of books so the rest of them have more space to
flourish.
The
good ones have more of a chance.
Exactly.
Dante's Inferno is pretty good.
Oh, yeah?
I read that in college.
I've never actually read it.
It's quite interesting. I mean, if you're reading it as an academic study. If you're just reading it for fun, then no.
No.
Don't do that. Because you need a professor that are like, oh, in this level of hell, he put these five dudes he didn't like. And you're like, ha ha ha.
I guess I'll go take a class.
Yeah.
So, I'm a BC 2082.
Oh, yeah. Is it?
And you're GJ 2087.
Yeah. I thought it was R. I thought it'd be GR.
They all 2087. They had three names, and they used the first two.
Oh. Okay.
BC and GJ sound cooler than BR and GR, anyway.
Grr and brr.
Well, grr kind of works. BR 2082 sounds like a
beer.
A bad microbrew. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beer 2082, the beer of the future. We made it with some ingredient that never normally goes in beer. Also, it's organic. That makes it better.
No. False.
Organic is a grocery term. That means we think we're better than you. That, also, we cost twice as much.
That should be the next Dan Brown thriller.
Yeah.
Runs around at Whole Foods trying to figure out the truth. So, Inferno by Dan Brown. Chosen because this is the beginning of our bestseller month.
Welcome to bestseller month. Part two.
Yeah.
Year two.
I couldn't convince Ben to read the second Fifty Shades of Grey book.
Sorry, listeners, if you want that to happen, you're going to have to clamor for it, because I'm not doing it without probably at least...
We need like 1,000 listeners demanding it.
I say a minimum of probably 15 people saying, yes, do it, it was the best thing ever.
And as we probably don't even have 15 listeners, not worried about it.
I feel pretty secure in my not having to read more Fifty Shades.
So, my substitute suggestion was Inferno, which is what we read this week.
Yeah. Because while I did thoroughly dislike the Da Vinci Code, it's not even close to the amount of hatred I had for 50 Shades of Grey.
That was... Yeah. So, if you are wondering who this Dan Brown is and what this Inferno is, he is the author of the Da Vinci Code, which blew up, I don't know, 5-6 summers ago?
Yeah.
Everyone was obsessed for like a year.
Yeah, because it was controversial to people who don't know things, I think. That was my impression of it, at least.
I'll go ahead and spoiler alert it for anyone who doesn't want to bother to read it. The plot of the Da Vinci Code was essentially that Jesus and Mary Magdalene got married and had kids, and the descendants of Jesus in the modern day world don't know they're descendants of Jesus, but they are. And Robert Langdon discovers it through art and stuff.
Yeah.
And that pissed a ton of people off because
yeah.
Jesus got married.
People who don't believe in the humanity of Jesus, but only the divinity of Jesus, had some issues with that.
But it also pissed off the fan fiction writers who were like, no Judas and Jesus.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Number one popular Bible pairing, fan fiction.
Not surprising.
This book, however, does not have anything to do with that.
Yeah, no religion, other than they go into a bunch of churches, I guess.
Yeah. We will issue a spoiler policy, though. It only came out a month or so ago, and I know some people at least are planning on reading it. So, if you want to read Inferno by Dan Brown and don't want to be spoiled, because it is full of twists, because it is a Dan Brown novel, then I suggest you stop listening right now.
Yeah, and I'm going to say this as someone who usually doesn't care even a little bit about spoilers. If you actually are planning to read this book, seriously turn it off now, because the twists towards the end of this book make reading the first part, the first about 300 pages of this book, completely pointless.
Yeah, I would say that if I knew the twist going in, I wouldn't even care.
Yeah, I wouldn't even read it.
I'd be like, okay, that sounds good. Which is funny because I went to a Schlitterbahn several weeks ago with some friends, and one of my friends had read this book recently because her mom told her to. And she said, are you ever going to read it? And I said, I don't know, probably not. Do you mind if I spoil it for you? I said, no. And then we got distracted because giant waves were coming at us, and she never actually managed to tell me the spoilers. And then after I read it, I was like, thank God. Yeah.
So, that being said, here we go.
Yeah. So, people aren't actually out to kill Robert Langdon. He didn't get shot in the back of the head. He wasn't in a hospital. He doesn't have retrograde amnesia. Sienna Brooks is working for the bad guys, and at the end of the book, everyone's infected with a virus that makes you infertile.
The evil mastermind wins.
Woo woo!
Just like I've been begging for all these years.
And it was kind of nice.
It was.
But then at the same time, it was also like, race against the clock, totally pointless.
Yes.
So I don't know about that one. I would have liked, well, the point, I guess, of it going the week before was that it was global by the time they even found it. But, you know, I like the showing up right after the bag bursts. Because they never would have been able to contain that shit anyway.
Yeah.
Everyone ran out into the street.
That was my thought.
So, if you've ever seen a zombie movie or an outbreak movie or anything, you should know that quarantine never worked.
I was actually turning mental cartwheels trying to figure out how they would discover that it hadn't actually been released.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe he screwed it up. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe he's not such a genius. And then it turns out that, no, it was released and it probably does work.
It wasn't the plague.
Like, good luck!
I thought for being such a scary guy talking about everyone descending into hell, that coming up with such a humane solution seemed a little out of character.
Yes, a humane, arguably not ethical solution.
Yeah.
But
didn't kill anybody.
Yeah, considering that he seemed cool with killing 3 or 4 billion of us. That's probably, what he came up with is probably better than that.
Yeah. There's like, oh, those people just can't have kids now. But you're totally fine otherwise. I was like, oh, wow. I was expecting everyone to be, like, dropping dead of the plague, so.
Right.
I guess less dramatic, but better for the world.
Yeah.
Because everyone's not thrown into chaos. Well, I guess we should probably give some background now that we've just started talking about the end of the book.
Since we're talking about not Harry Potter, here's some background on the book.
Genre?
Thriller. I guess a little bit mystery.
Kind of a mystery.
It's
definitely in that vein.
Yeah, it's the mystery in the style of, ooh, we have to follow clues to try to unravel the plan.
Yeah, not necessarily, like, find the killer or anything. Although in this case, they did think that guy was going to be a killer.
Is Bertrand Zobrist the Riddler?
Kinda. He's lucky that the guy who's, well, he's not lucky, but they're lucky that the guy who's looking for him just happens to know, like, everything about Dante's Inferno.
You're right.
And world history in every city and piece of art ever made.
Yeah, and every piece of art from the Renaissance onward, or before that.
Thanks, Robert Langdon.
Yeah. He knows so much.
That was a couple of times during these books, chapters are just open explaining, you know, oh, how this church was built, or how this custom operates, or something about this painting. And I always imagined it kind of being in a Robert Langdon voice, I guess, even though he wasn't technically, like, telling us that. And I was like, this is an info dump for the sake of an info dump. Like, Dan Brown just wanted to be like, look, guys, I did research. And sometimes when someone started explaining the history of something, I just skipped it. Fuck it. This is not interesting. I love history, but this is not interesting. The horses thing was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
That was about it. So, plot synopsis.
Babies suck.
Seriously. That's the plot synopsis.
That's the plot synopsis. That wasn't just me lashing out.
As far as we can tell, that is Dan Brown's true opinion. I don't want to give you an entire summary because we don't need to go over all the twists, but essentially Robert Langdon, who's the star of the first three books that Dan Brown wrote, wakes up in the hospital, apparently with retrograde amnesia, and finds out that someone's after him to kill him, and he doesn't know why. So he, with the help of a doctor named Sienna Brooks, is running away from these people, all the meanwhile trying to figure out all these clues pertaining to Dante's inferno to stop something. They don't really know what that something is, they don't really know what they're looking for, but they're on the run for their lives, so that's pretty good incentive to GTFO. And that's about it, without spoiling anything. Even though we've already spoiled it all, but whatever.
It's alright. We'll re-spoil it later.
Yeah. Setting.
Florence, Venice, Istanbul.
In that order.
In that order.
Get a lot of background about Florence, because that's where Dante grew up. Venice, we are reminded a billion times, is sinking into the water. And Istanbul is cool.
Is there a lot of water in Venice? I think I've heard that before.
I think I've heard that rumor. somewhere.
Yeah.
Point of view tense. It's third person close around multiple characters. Robert Langdon is definitely the focus, but you do get close person around, I'd say, three or four, maybe even five other people. It occasionally lapses into the present tense, but that's mostly when it's just like, this church stands here and looks like this, because right. It still exists. But then otherwise, the entire plot's past tense, so.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's definitely primarily around Robert Langdon. You do get a significant amount of other characters, though. Probably, I mean, he's probably 65-70% of the narration.
Yeah.
It's that frequent delving into other characters. It's probably about 2-to-1 in favor of him versus the rest.
Yeah, I would say his chapters tend to be a skosh longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get a couple-page chapter surrounding another person. Yeah. And then back to Langdon and his adventures, and then another couple pages or so around somebody else.
Yeah.
So, I'd say that's roughly the breakdown.
And so, because of that, Robert Langdon is the protagonist. He knows everything, as we mentioned.
Yeah, he's also the one who figures all this shit out and leads everyone around. So I'd say he is clearly the protagonist in this situation. Even though he never knows what's going on, he is trying to figure it out, so.
Yes.
And everyone relies on him to figure it out. Because they're like, we don't know what the internet is. Use your magic brain.
Even when they try to use the internet a couple times, his magic brain turns out to be more knowledgeable than Google.
Yeah. So suck on that, Google. I bet they're using Bing.
Yeah, they probably were. When you want to Bing something, please use Google. They sponsor the show. We wish. Boy, I wish Google sponsored
that
the show.
That would be amazing. I've been just waiting for Audible to sponsor us.
I know, they sponsor everybody else's podcast.
And ours actually deals with books. But no, they don't care about
We need to hire a new publicist. Or a publicist.
A publicist.
Maybe our intern could do that.
Yeah, make him cold call people. Perfect job for churn.
Put out some press releases. I like it.
So what do we know about Robert Langdon?
He's a professor of symbology and art in general, something like that.
I think so.
I don't know. Art and symbology.
Specifically related to art.
Yeah.
At Harvard.
Right.
And just, you know, symbology is not actually a thing you can be a professor in.
That's too bad.
So don't worry about it.
I guess you'd have to be an art professor with a specialization in symbology.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are some people who are experts in symbology.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
He has an eidetic, which is an awesome word. In other words, perfect memory. He dresses like a nerdy professor.
It is Harris Tweed.
That gets mentioned a lot, really.
It does.
I
didn't recognize you. You're not dressed like a nerd.
Yeah.
A couple people say that to
him. He loves his Mickey Mouse watch.
Oh my god damn. Do not step between Robert Langdon and his Mickey Mouse watch.
And he knows everything when it's convenient for the plot for him to know everything. And occasionally he doesn't know something when it's convenient for the plot for him not to know that thing.
Yeah, he seems to be an expert in an awful lot of areas.
I mean, it's all art related, but, like, I have a master's degree in music. I don't know, like, 10% of as much of the field of music as he apparently knows about the field of art.
Yeah, and I believe everything related to Dante, since he did at least bother to mention that he has, like, an entire semester-long class on cymbals in the Inferno.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, I'm willing to believe that he taught that class recently and remembers just about everything relating to Dante.
Right. That's cool. I was in for that part.
But, like, all the other random art and history shit that he just knows, I was like, this is getting questionable.
Right. I mean, and I will acknowledge that a person with a doctorate who's been professoring for several years and has written a handful of books will definitely know a lot of things about a few really specific areas in their subject.
Mm-hmm.
So he should know more about art than I know about music, yeah, is what I'm saying, but he doesn't need to know everything, including, like, random historical stuff that, like, he seems to know the whole history of Italy that happened during the art that he's aware of, so, yeah, you know, all of it.
Yeah. I did like when they were in the one museum, and he's like, oh, I took a tour once of the secret passages, so I know how to do everything.
Right?
What?
The tour of the secret passages? Seriously?
His memory was kind of fuzzy, though, because he had a little bit too much wine. So his eidetic memory is failing him. I was like, no, it's not, because he still knows where everything is.
Right.
Like, that's not the same thing. So, there's that.
I remember this doorway being slanted. Robert, you were drunk.
Go home.
Now it's the wrong door. He falls down the stairs. And the soldiers catch him.
That would be hilarious. Sienna's like, fuck. Actually, if that happened, like, 100 pages in the book would be way shorter, because they'd be like, hey, we're not actually here to kill you, we're just here to tell you what's going on.
We just wanted to ask you some questions about some symbols. You could have just emailed my Harvard account.
Hey, I checked it this morning, golf. See, what they should have done is, instead of showing up with an entire, like, crazy team of guys in SWAT gear with guns, just have, like, one dude approach with his hands up, like, I just want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And then maybe instead of running away, he would have, like, listened.
Yeah. Well, so what exactly was the logic for not just keeping him in custody in the first place? Because they just wanted to deliver the artifact without him being involved?
Well, it was... He went to the museum and found the Dante mask with the guy, and then they left, and, now I'm trying to remember why Vientha was chasing them in the first place.
Right?
The fat guy died, and then they captured Langdon and pumped him full of drugs and...
So maybe they were chasing him. Maybe the whole post-hospital thing was just trying to get him, to convince him that there's a good reason for a couple days of his memory to be missing.
Yeah. But then, like, after that, it was weird, because I thought he had, like, gone rogue, but he hadn't, and they set up... Well, the provost was working separately from, like, Bruder and company,
right,
though. So the provost just wanted to, like, get some info out of him, I think, and stop him. And then Bruder was like, why has he gone rogue? But I don't know how, like, they got separated in the first place. So.
Yeah, I could argue that this is one of those stories where the schemes are slightly too elaborate, perhaps.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, because... Oh, shit. I think, basically, it just needed to happen for the plot that... That both sides thought Langdon was rogue.
I guess.
There you go. Moving on.
We need him to be running for a long time.
He used to run a lot.
Through museums.
Yeah, when I thought the back of his head had been shot and he was being treated and stuff, I was like, this man should not be capable of running around this much. He got shot in the back of the head. But since they just cut him and stitched him, I guess.
Yeah.
It makes more sense.
It's a little surface wound with a bunch of stitches to make it look worse than it is.
Okay. Do we have anything else to say about Robert Langdon?
I don't know if we have much to say about any characters.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Sienna Brooks. Because she, I would say she's the secondary protagonist.
Yeah. She's a wunderkind child genius IQ of 200 plus.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently.
Apparently.
She was able to memorize A Midsummer Night's Dream when she was 7 in, like, a day.
I was a little...
What?
I was a little skeptical that her two main characters were a man with a perfect memory and a woman with an IQ of 200 plus. I was like, okay, this is an unlikely pair.
Make her smart, but make her IQ like 180. I mean, come on, 200? Come on!
Or just have her be like a smart doctor lady.
Yeah, doctors are smart. But the point was that she was so smart that she didn't fit into society.
Right.
And it depressed her.
Right, because
she was deep or whatever.
Because people can't be depressed without having an IQ of 208.
I don't know.
I don't know. What's the logic here?
I thought her backstory was stupid as hell.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna defend that shit. So there's that.
Yeah.
So. I'm just saying, if I was in a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream with some fucking 7-year-old who was like, I'm Puck, I'd be like, go to hell, child. Get out of here. And all her hair fell out. That's the other significant Sienna Brooks trait, is that she's bald and wears a wig.
Right.
And I thought that was bullshit, too, because it didn't fall off until, like, the very end when it was, like, I don't know, when he engineered it to fall off. And I was like, they've been running and jumping and fighting, uh-huh. And how has that damn wig not fallen off? Like, this is bullshit. I do not concur.
So
unbelievable.
Is she kind of an emotional person? Because that's what motivates her, even though she doesn't really show any signs of it until the end?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, her whole thing was driven by emotion.
Right.
Like, her desire to save the world, and then her depression that she couldn't save the world, and then falling madly in love, and then trying to help him, and then being disgusted by him, and I don't know. It's all kind of driven by passions.
Yeah. Though I don't feel like I got a lot of that from her. Until the end of the book.
Yeah, not until the reveal. There was, like, one moment at the very beginning where she thought about Langdon and thought, he's kind of cute. And then she started crying because he would never want to be with her. I was like, oh, fuck.
Oh, I forgot that part.
But then that didn't come up again until, like, the very end. I was like, thank God. I was, like, really worried. She was just, the entire book was going to be like, I'm not good enough. But she didn't really do that.
Oh,
so
Lord.
That would have been bad. So at least she doesn't do that.
Yeah. All right.
And she's really hella smart, so...
She is really hella smart. And so is the villain of this book.
Bertrand Zobrist?
The victorious villain of this book.
Except that he's dead.
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't really bother him too much.
Well, you know. He died for his cause. Actually, we don't really know the specific circumstances of his death.
He jumped off a building because Sinsky's team was going to catch him.
Yeah, but... Why did he have to jump off the building? Why couldn't he just refuse to answer their questions?
Because he's a crazy motherfucker.
Well, he is a crazy motherfucker. He thinks that the world is suffering from an overpopulation problem, which arguably it is.
Okay.
And he thinks that reducing our numbers by a third or so would go a long way towards...
And it has to happen, like, now.
Oh, yeah, that's the other part of it. He thinks within a century the human race will be extinct.
Yeah.
Unless something is done.
So, and on the flip side, he's also a leader of the transhumanist movement, which essentially believes that we can use our knowledge of technology to improve human beings. So, they were kind of talking about creating a race of super beings, almost, you know? Tweaking their genes so that they don't get disease and they're smarter and stronger and et cetera, et cetera. They think that that's all a good idea, but that if the human race dies in the next 100 years, we won't have enough time to actually accomplish that goal. So the first thing he needs to do is kill off a couple billion people, and then the rest of the people left can be allowed to flourish. Essentially.
Right. And he's... Actually, one of the things about this character that I like is that he's a villain with a motivation that is laid out for you to understand.
He's like, not just a bad dude.
Right. Like, he would be... If a couple billion people dropped dead tomorrow, he wouldn't really shed any tears, because in the long run, it's what needed to happen, but... At the same time, he has a reason for that. He's mm-hmm. not just like a megalomaniac. Not like a megalomaniac or something.
Yeah, I mean, he's crazy, but he's not, like, evil, I guess, is the best way to put it. Definitely not just for the sake. He's not like, I just want to kill a billion people.
Right. It's like pain and suffering.
He's more like, I have to save the human race, and this is the only way to do it.
Hard decisions must be made.
So, understandable, at least. I did like that about him, too. And apparently he had beautiful green eyes.
Apparently.
And he just hits on ladies and sleeps with them. Well, yeah. That's what he does to Sienna.
Well, if you're a genius with beautiful green eyes, I guess the ladies go for that.
Yeah.
Or at least the super smart bald ladies do.
Yeah, I guess we should also point out that there is kind of a twist there in that originally when you hear the perspective of his lover, they don't specify gender, and you're led to believe that it's this guy who showed up that is Zobrist's disciple and has been his lover for years.
I've actually never been with a man before.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, okay. Right, and I was like, Dan Brown's acknowledging gay people exists. I mean, I'm not thrilled he made the bad guy gay, and he's the only gay character.
Both of us, without consulting each other, kind of had the same reaction of, oh, okay, it's going to be gay characters. Well, why is the evil guy the gay... Are we going to have to talk about this? Yeah. And it's like, oh, it's the woman. Okay.
Yeah, it was misdirection. It was actually Sienna, not that guy. But Ben did point out that even though it did end up being Sienna and not that guy, that it was clearly intentional to lead you to believe that it was that guy. So he was still acknowledging the existence of gay people. He just didn't actually bother to make any of his characters gay. But you know, if that book had been written 15 or 20 years ago, an author probably wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't have successfully misdirected you.
Yeah, or maybe even tried.
Yeah, I mean, if they did try, we would probably be tricked by it reading it now. But people wouldn't have remembered it. Wouldn't necessarily remembered it for that. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it would have been the big controversial book of that summer.
Yeah. But in 2013, when you write a scene like that, people are just like, oh, okay, he's gay. That's like immediately my brain knows. So it's a dude, whatever.
Right.
And maybe some other people were scandalized by that, but I was mostly just offended he made the gay guy bad.
Yeah, the people who thought Jesus having sex with a woman was scandalous were probably the same people who were scandalized by this.
Yeah. I want the plot twist in the next book to be that Robert Langdon's gay. That would be awesome.
And that's why he never
perpetual bachelor.
That's why he never stays with any of these lady assistants.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he'll finally have a male helper, and they'll hook up.
My suggestion to you, Dan Brown. Robert Langdon plus man.
That's right.
That's our humble suggestion to make your book better.
That's right.
Okay, moving on. We have Elizabeth Sinsky. She's the director of the World Health Organization. So, powerful woman.
Yes. And she is out to stop Zobrist because...
Yeah, she's number one enemy.
Yeah. In a scene that I rather enjoyed, though probably not for the reasons I was supposed to, he calls her to this secretive meeting at some high rollers club, basically. Yeah. And he confronts her with this crisis, and by confronts her with this overpopulation crisis, I mean screams at her like a maniac.
Yeah.
Until she says, fuck you, I'm leaving. And then she pulls out her phone and he's like, you're gonna call the authorities? It won't work. Cell signals are blocked in photo. All right. I'm gonna devote the next year
to hunting your ass down, exactly, motherfucker.
To stopping you. I loved that. I was like, see, this is what happens when villains monologue in real life.
I just thought it was funny. She shows up and he's like, overpopulation's a problem. And instead of, he's like, I presented all the facts to you, and how do you not believe me? And it's like, it's because you were like, the World Health Organization sucks and you're a fucking idiot. Yeah. Everything you've done is completely wrong and the world's gonna end. And she was like, oh God.
That's not a very sane or civil cold open. Maybe you should have built up to that point.
That's the best way to present your argument, dude. So imagine like foaming at the mouth, like, ah!
Instead of, I'm concerned about overpopulation. Let's discuss that a little bit.
Let's have a conversation. What are you guys doing?
Do you think your tactics go far enough? Like, kind of break it gently.
Yeah. And instead of just being like, oh, the condom thing was a failure, you dumb idiot.
Yeah, the Catholics kicked your ass.
Why don't you know anything? God. Okay.
Now, will you ally with me? I want to kill 3 billion people. No! Never! Get away from me, weirdo!
Yeah, also presenting it that way, like, he basically just straight up tells her, like, we have to kill 3 billion people.
So you remember that Black Death thing dropped the population by about a third? Some people argue triggered the Renaissance.
Yeah, it was like the best thing to ever happen in human history. Telling someone the Black Death was the best thing to happen to the history of Europe is, like, not the best way to phrase that.
Now, you want to shake hands and be on my side? I'm afraid to touch you now, honestly.
Yeah, he's like, the bubonic plague, oh, so great!
Fap, fap, fap.
She's like, oh, shit. You're insane. And like, that's the crazy part, is he acts like such a fucking psycho, and then at the end, like, the virus, makes a third of the people sterile, but doesn't kill anybody.
Right.
But you're expecting it to, like, horribly mangle and kill people because he's acted so unreasonably. Like, his 9-minute video where he's talking about entering hell and
right.
I am the shade and half the population needs to die. I'm like, why don't you just rationally explain yourself?
Yeah. So here's what I see as the problem, and various organizations won't go far enough and they won't listen to those of us who think this is truly a crisis, and here's my solution. And many of you will think this is unethical, but I've kind of already enacted it, so good luck with that.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh.
Don't need any of this crazy Dante symbolism.
Right.
Basically, if the bad guy was less crazy, then the book wouldn't... It would just be, like, people waking up one day and seeing this video and being like, oh, shit. And, like, that would be the book.
I would consider... I would consider reading the book that is...
Dealt with the aftermath?
That begins with the aftermath.
Yeah.
Provided it was written by someone other than Dan Brown.
Robert Lifton wakes up and he's like, I can use symbols and art to make people fertile again. And then he, like, goes to a bunch of museums, looks like pregnancy statues and stuff.
It's
and like
surrounding infertile people with fertility symbols.
Yeah.
All right, try fucking with these symbols around you. Are you pregnant yet? Robert Langdon's weird second career is a quack fertility doctor.
What a great book. We're just talking about nothing. It has anything to do with this book.
Well, there's not a lot to talk about, honestly.
We've already talked about most of it. We have some other characters, but they're not terribly important.
Yeah, I mean, I think the provost is worth mentioning just because his organization
is interesting.
Interesting, and they're kind of a key component of the plot, yeah. But it sounds like their main job is to keep people and things hidden from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that the ethic of the organization is pretty much ask no questions and follow through no matter what.
Yeah. Always do what your client asks.
Yeah.
Don't question them.
Yeah. And somehow this has not bitten them in the ass before this guy.
I mean, I guess they typically go off of recommendations and stuff. And it sounds like they do some unethical things, but nothing, like, I guess, too horrible.
Right.
Especially like, horribly business-related things as opposed to...
Yeah, they mostly, like, hide researchers so that no one can steal their patent until they've filed it. It sounds
yeah,
like,
that
kind,
like
of, that kind of stuff. For, like, big corporations or governments or...
Yeah.
And there's some shadiness involved, but it's probably more in the form of forging documents rather than murdering people.
Well, yeah, and they apparently have a team of fake assassins, though. I didn't really get that part.
They're almost like a team of, like, the ultimate actors.
Yeah.
They're, like, just really good improv actors.
Set up everything and then carry through with the scene no matter what.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's still kind of wacky sometimes. But yeah, well, the provost is interesting in the fact that he doesn't really have morals. His moral is just do what the customer said.
Right.
And then at the end he does grow some because he thinks Zobrist's plan sounds pretty horrific. And he actually gets arrested at the end of the book.
Yeah.
So he gets punished for helping out.
Yeah. Sinsky wins.
Yeah. Well, kinda.
Kinda.
Not the fact she actually stopped it from happening.
Yeah.
But yeah, one important thing we forgot to mention about Sinsky is that she can't have a baby. Yeah. And apparently this is extremely important.
Yeah, so I guess we're just going to go ahead and roll over into the issue section here.
Feminism!
Yay!
Yes, Sinsky can't have a baby, and every time the narration is from her point of view... She makes sure to remind the reader that she cannot have a baby.
My life is slightly sadder because I can't have a baby.
And I'm like, is this really the most important thing to you right now? You're like trying to catch this guy who's...
Gotta stop this plague. This madman's gonna kill 2 billion people. And that would be horrible, especially because my life would then be slightly sadder because I could never have a baby. Like, damn it! Stop bringing that up!
Really? What is happening?
Who thinks of that in that moment?
Yeah.
Especially, like, a 60-year-old woman who has known this for over 40 years.
Yeah, and, like, isn't married, which, again, I was telling Ben earlier, I thought that was really stupid, because she was engaged in her 20s, but then she didn't fucking tell the guy she couldn't have a kid until they were engaged.
Yeah.
And he mentioned he wanted kids, which, again, proves... Before you get engaged to someone, children, talk about whether or not you want to have kids. And if someone says they do, but they can live with not having them, they're lying.
Right.
And if someone says they don't, but they might consider having them in the future, they're lying. Don't get engaged if you have different ideas about babies. Pisses me off so bad. So...
I was, like, imagining it in the form of a savage love call or something. Yeah, I'm engaged to this guy, and I'm infertile, but I haven't told him yet. Do I need to tell him before the wedding?
Oh my god.
Why do you people even call?
How do you not know anything about anything?
Why doesn't anybody talk to anybody?
Yeah, so her fiancé's like, this will look good hanging above a crib. Oh, BT-dubs, can't have kids. And then he's like, oh, we're not even together anymore.
This would have been a good thing to bring up 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I was like, so am I led to believe that her, like, one experience being engaged was so traumatic that she never dated again and found a guy who legitimately doesn't care if he has kids or is okay with, I don't know, adoption? That's
right.
Something people who can't have babies but really want them do.
That's true. Right, it's really frustrating to see this really smart, really successful head of an international organization who apparently, because she had a bad experience with love due to her own piss-poor communication skills and her upset at her inability to have children, has decided that she can't have a relationship and... is going to let this define her.
I thought it would be way more interesting if she had a husband and, like, an adopted child.
Yeah. I also thought she would have been more believable if she had become infertile at some point later in life than rather in childhood, if she was going to be hung up on it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, the argument you can make is maybe you don't care when you're 19, and then when you're 40, you do.
Right.
Like, I don't want a kid. And then you're like, oh man, that sucks that I can never have kids.
That's a bummer. Maybe I'll see if I can adopt a kid.
Maybe I'll go ask my husband, who I told years ago that I couldn't have children. I'm going to throttle against something. It makes me so angry. People who are like, oh yeah, married for 5 years, got divorced. Why do you get divorced? Well, he said he didn't want kids, and 5 years into the marriage, he still didn't, and I did. Then why did you get married?
Idiots.
What is wrong with you?
I edited out the crashing noises of Gabs walking around and just thrashing our studio. Yeah.
I will move on from that topic because apparently I didn't realize it was going to enrage me so much.
I want to hire a Foley artist so they can make crashing noises. I want to have that as a sound effect I can put in the background anytime one of us goes on a big rant.
Yelling!
It's like that's a breaking glass and furniture thumping.
Damn you! Our other issue is Sienna, and we get her whole backstory. She's trying to save the world and goes to... Oh, I don't remember where she goes. What country does she end up in?
Philippines.
The Philippines. Trying to help people there. She's a doctor, and the poverty is too overwhelming. And so she, like, has a nervous breakdown and for some reason runs, like, 3 miles into the slums. I didn't really get that part.
You know, went on a solid, like, half-hour jog like you do when you have a freakout.
I didn't really get that part. Ends up in the slums, and then these guys try to rape her, but... this old woman stabs, like, a dude through his entire stomach, which is kind of cool, I guess. And then she runs away from them and freaks out so much she loses all her hair, I guess.
Yeah.
Essentially. But I mostly wanted to bring it up because this big traumatic event in her past that causes all of this pain and trauma, which I think... I'm not going to criticize her for that. I think if you almost get raped by three strangers and you are traumatized by it for the years to come, that's okay.
Right.
Because that is traumatizing.
Right.
She should be going to a therapist and stuff, but, like, I'm not going to criticize her for being freaked out about it. My main criticism is more of Dan Brown for actually writing that into the story.
Right. As a writing choice or criticizing it as a trope, because it comes up.
Yeah, it's the threatening your main female characters with rape, and it comes up more often than you would think. And it's probably come up in works of fiction where you haven't even realized it, because at some point, the main woman in the story is going to get threatened by a bad guy with rape.
Yeah.
And so is this more of a, like, did that really have to happen? I mean, they could have, like, mugged her.
Right.
Or she could have just not randomly run into the outskirts of the city.
Right, like, being in a... crushingly overpopulated city of millions that was full of abject poverty could have been a life-changing event in and of itself.
Yeah. Especially if you have a history of severe clinical depression.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, hopelessness. Here it is, like, in person.
Yeah. That would be pretty awful. So, I understand, but I'm just saying, it didn't necessarily have to happen that way.
Yeah.
On the non-ranty side, there are actually pretty much 50-50 men, women in the books.
Yeah, the balance was pretty good, especially as far as who was getting dialogue and time on the page. And
A lot of the kind of random people they run into along the way are men and women. It's definitely not really slanted one way or the other. I think there might be like one or two more guys, but... I remember being impressed while I was reading it that I couldn't really tell if there was an imbalance or not, so...
Yeah,
so... I was okay with it. So, at least, good job on that front, male author writing women into your books, even if we have some issues with how you did it. Thank you for trying.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I guess the big issue of this book, and probably kind of ties into the theme as far as we can tell... is the issue of overpopulation and like ethical ways to deal with it, and to a little bit, I guess to a lesser degree, also genetic engineering. And so over the course of the book, I kind of get the impression that Dan Brown
thinks there's an overpopulation problem.
Thinks there's a overpopulation crisis, maybe even. And that measures are going to have to be taken, because you never hear anyone defending, or I should say, you never hear anyone who has a problem with the methods that, say, Zobrist is presenting argue or make a counter argument.
Yeah, so we were talking about how the transhumanist movement is actually presented in a pretty good light, because, or I'd say fair light.
Yeah.
You have the people who are the transhumanists who are making the argument for their cause, which, okay, fair enough. And then you have the people on the other side saying, here are all the problems with this. You know, like, yeah, genetically improving people sounds great, but then if that costs a lot of money, then you're going to have the super rich, super great humans, and then the poor subhuman species, and, you know, this horrible disparity, and, yeah, okay, good point. And then when he brings up the overpopulation issue, no one ever says, you know, here's why I find your numbers suspicious or wrong, or here's some things going on why I don't think overpopulation is a problem. Pretty much everyone just accepts overpopulation as a problem. So Sinsky doesn't want Zobrist to kill all those people, but she even admits to herself, yeah, overpopulation's a problem. And when Landing gets presented with all this stuff, he thinks killing half the world's population is a bad idea, but he again, you know, can't help but notice that there's too many people on the planet. So no one really speaks up to say that maybe those people are wrong. So maybe Dan Brown thinks those people aren't wrong.
Yeah, man, I don't want to label him as someone who thinks there's an imminent overpopulation crisis and thinks desperate measures must be taken.
Yeah, I don't think he's necessarily condoning sterilizing a third world population.
I certainly don't assume that. And we don't authors don't always, you know, if an author has a viewpoint in a book, it doesn't always mean that that's their viewpoint either.
Yeah, that's true. We can't just automatically be like, Dan Brown hates overpopulation.
Right.
Because he's just writing a thriller. I mean,
right, and he needs something as a basis for the plot, I suppose.
Yeah, and he likes writing about controversial issues.
Yeah.
So, because I think he had, like, Black Matter and Angels and Demons and Jesus and Da Vinci Code and Masonic stuff and his last one, which I didn't read. So, I mean, he's picking, you know, specifically.
Right. He's aiming for some buttons. Genetic engineering is certainly a button.
Yeah.
And even more so because I think the impression I get, at least, is that a lot of the people who are a little more hysterical about genetic engineering don't seem to understand how it actually works. not that you can't be informed and have ethical issues with it, because you certainly can be informed and have ethical issues with it, but I get the impression that, I guess I don't really need to go into it so much, but like he creates this vector virus in this book, which is something that we're pretty far away from being able to do, probably, though it's hard to say with a new field. Sometimes you say that, and then a week later, here it is!
We have a vector virus!
But, I mean, I've read things that have said that where they're not even sure that's a real possibility, at least as far as, like, the kind of wholesale change that's described in this book. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, whereas some of the people who are opposed to genetically engineered crops seem to think that we're somehow going to become a mutant race of zombie humans because of corn having a gene altered to grow larger. And that's pretty ignorant on the flip side. On the flip side of the argument, too. But it is definitely something that you see in the news fairly regularly and that people are concerned with, especially where food is concerned.
Yeah, he should have brought up Whole Foods, man. Missed the perfect opportunity. They probably don't exist in Europe.
Well, I say there are some valid concerns with genetically modified foods. It's just the concern isn't that it's going to turn me into some weird alien monster.
Yeah, I mean, some of it does. I'm like, ugh. But I'm always like, I'm not a scientist. I don't know things. Let's see here. Have we already given all the plot twists away?
I think so.
I mean, basically, what happens is Langdon finally gets caught by Bruder and company and learns that the entire first part of the book, no one was actually trying to kill him. He was running away from people who just wanted to calmly talk to him, and that he didn't actually get shot at, and the whole hospital thing was a fake, and Sienna's apartment was a fake. So everything was just a really, really elaborate ruse, which kind of made me go, what?
Like, then why did you have the first two-thirds of this?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting when I thought Vientha was trying to kill them, and then she got killed instead. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, no, she was just trying to prove that she was on his side and take him back to the provost, and then got unnecessarily killed. So that kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on there? And then at the end, when they discover that Zobrist already released the virus the week before, it's kind of cool, because the bad guys don't often win in these scenarios, but then at the same time, it does make you go, okay, so the first part of the book was unnecessary, and now the second part of the book is unnecessary? Like, is there a point to this book?
It's like, why did I just read this again? I have a couple other issues with the write-in, like to touch on as long as we're already here.
Yeah.
One thing that I didn't have as much of an issue with in this, as opposed to the Da Vinci Code, is I feel like it was, I think it was written maybe slightly better. Like, the prose wasn't painful to me quite as often.
I can't remember how well the Da Vinci Code was written, so.
I felt like I was being talked down to the whole time I read it. I have a really strong memory of getting into that book and going, like, is this written for sixth graders? Like, seriously, use a three-syllable word every once in a while.
His vocabulary was better in this book.
It was a lot better in this book. So I was pleased that I didn't have to put up with that again. I actually enjoyed reading this quite a bit more than the Da Vinci Code. Not to say that I really enjoyed it. But we'll get to that in a minute. Some of the dialogue is not very realistic. I had a couple of brief 50 Shades flashbacks. It wasn't that level of bad, and certainly wasn't consistently that bad. But there were definitely every probably three or four pages, someone would say something where I'd flinch just a little bit, like, no one sounds that way. In fact, no one in the rest of this book sounds that way. Why do you sound that way for one line? That is weird.
Yeah. So some of the dialogue is kind of awkward. And the other thing I thought was kind of awkward was because the book was so obviously structured to be like a big mystery of what's going on, is that sometimes characters' chapters were written so vaguely that it, like, almost didn't make sense. So, like, all of Vientha, the fake assassin's chapters, are written in a way to make you think she's still an assassin. But then when you actually learn what's going on, it's like, why would she even be having those thoughts? Because she didn't fucking... What? And the guy with the allergic reaction to the, like, fake beard and shit he'd been wearing, he was, like, kind of unnecessarily cagey for me.
Yeah.
And my other pet peeve was, like, the guy who was watching the video, instead of just giving you a chapter on the video, it's divided into, like, 9 chapters, and it's like, here's the first little part, here's the second little part, you don't even get to see the end of it until, like, practically the end of the book, and it's like, oh my god, this is not necessary.
To say if it was actually divided across 9 chapters, that would actually kind of fit.
Yeah, the Manhunters of Hell. Solid point, sir. Solid point.
I guess I have one or two more specific nitpicks. There was at least one chapter that I thought was entirely unnecessary, where they are looking for a copy of Dante's Inferno, and they can't find it because Florentians observe the Sabbath on Monday because of tourism on the weekends. And I was like, did you write this chapter just to let me know you knew that? Because I don't care that you know that, Dan Brown.
And then just make it Tuesday, damn it.
Yeah, and then go into a church and have an extended conversation or an encounter with this woman that involves an iPhone, and all of a sudden I was going, is this product placement? What is happening in this chapter?
That was kind of a weird scene, because he's, like, just trying to read the canto, and she's like, how much does data cost in another country?
Well, she clearly had no concept of how data works in another country.
I know.
Like, couldn't you take 15 seconds to say, the page is already loaded, I'm not actually taking up any more data by swiping your screen right now?
Also, I just connected to the church's Wi-Fi, so it's not
good. That's right.
No data used!
And then, I guess, as far as a couple of things about the writing that I liked. Oh, gosh, I left out a big one, actually, before I do that. One more issue, and that's that I was bored stiff for a lot of this book. It did not catch my attention. I didn't.
Yeah, Ben thought being on a race for his life was made dull.
I didn't care. And I don't know why that is. I don't think it was that poorly constructed. I think it's pretty...
thought it was pretty well crafted.
Yeah, I thought the structure of it was pretty standard thrillery type of stuff.
I didn't find it super compelling either. And I don't know, maybe it's just because we just didn't care that much about the characters. Because, you know,
I think that's a lot of it.
Character-driven folks.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, well, why do I really care about the plot if I don't really give a crap about the characters?
Right, like, I don't know who any of these people are or find any of them especially likable or hateable.
Didn't want to know what happened to Langdon's Mickey Mouse watch. Well, I got it back.
Yeah, that was... See, that was a good character detail, though. a couple of the things I did like... I mentioned that scene where Zobrist is being a maniac and Sinsky reacts appropriately, in my opinion. I did like that at the end the bad guys, or bad guy, I should say, got to win.
Yeah.
I thought that was...
Yeah, instead of saving it the last minute like usually happens, it was kind of cool that...
I was trying to figure out how they would save it. I was going, well, what's it going to turn out is happening? I was like, oh, it's going to turn out that it already happened, and it's totally happening.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that. I mean, that's a decision that most authors or movie studios or television networks, people who produce stories, are usually not brave enough to make that decision.
Uh-huh. And... in the vein of it, the book takes place in about a day, I'd say a little more than that, so less than 48 hours.
Yeah.
And as other books do too, actually, which helps add to the, like, intensity, figuring everything out now.
Right, yeah.
And does create incentive to, like, want to keep reading, even though neither one of us was, like, totally wrapped up in anything, but...
And he did dodge another one of my least favorite storytelling tropes, which is that the hero and heroine crammed together for a very short period of time don't all of a sudden form this romance that we're supposed to believe is going to last after 2 days.
They're going to become friends.
Yeah, and they're going to exchange emails, it sounds like.
Very pleasant. My question for the series, because this is technically part of a series, is if Dan Brown writes another book starring Robert Langdon, then will we see the effects and aftermath of the virus in that book?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. Maybe the next one will be no mystery symbology elements at all. It'll just be...
the world dealing with...
seeing what the world does.
Yeah.
Or maybe this was his... way to not have to write more Robert Langdon stories.
Yeah, that was Ben's theory.
It's made my world too complicated. I don't want to deal with it anymore.
Or they'll just show up in the next book and be like, well, nothing's really happened with that yet, but here's another mystery.
That's, if I had to pick what I thought was most likely, I would probably pick that one. My question, I suppose, it would have to be, if you could pull a lever that would kill half of the world's population, but would save the human race, and not pulling the lever, you wouldn't kill anyone in the moment, but the human race would eventually be doomed. Would you pull the lever?
Depends what eventually means. Yeah. If eventually isn't like a billion years, we'd be like, well, fuck it, we're doomed anyway.
Well, I'm with that.
If eventually means like 10 years from now, yeah, I would do it.
Well, yeah. I think, very selfishly, my question to that question would be like, which half am I in?
But I'm...
Because if I'm saving the human race, but I'm dying right now, then I don't really care that much. Nothing against the rest of you, but I kind of want to be around to enjoy it.
Well, if I pulled and everyone I knew died, that would blow a lot.
Yeah, that wouldn't be cool.
I'd be like, well, shit.
We're all going to be dead in 10 years if I don't pull the lever. But if I do pull the lever, you all live, but I die. I'm sorry, guys. We got 10 years. Unless one of y'all want to pull this lever.
Oh, good God. You jerk. What's your verdict?
I didn't dislike it. I don't think I feel strongly enough about it to dislike it, but I certainly don't like it.
I'd say read it if you like Dan Brown, if you're a thriller reader and you don't really care about that stuff. But if you're more in the vein of us and you don't really read that kind of stuff, I would say don't bother.
Yeah, I would say skip it unless you're inclined to read this sort of thing to begin with. Yeah.
So what are you reading right now?
I'm reading The Terror by Dan Simmons, the author of Hyperion, which we have previously podcasted. It's a really interesting book that I was annoyed I had to interrupt, but it's about the Franklin Arctic Expedition, which was a real Arctic expedition, and it's about all the hardships they went through on the way to the entire crew of both ships starving to death, apparently. But with the extra element of this weird supernatural monster thrown in that pops up every few chapters and takes out a crewman when, well, I wouldn't actually say when no one is looking. A lot of the time, everybody is looking. It's part of what makes it freaky. So, yeah, enjoying that.
I just finished The Spectacular Now by Tim Thorpe. I guess it just got made into a movie. I don't know if it's a wide release movie or like a tiny indie film. I'm not sure.
See, based on what you said, surely the movie would not have the same ending as the book.
I'm not sure.
Not if it was for wide release.
It's a YA novel, and it's kind of messed up. It kind of pissed me off. So, that's my thoughts on it.
If anyone has any thoughts they wish to share with us, you can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us, and we did get emailed this week.
Woo-hoo!
More book suggestions. Thanks, Woo! Amy. Novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us at novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes.
And if you do find us on iTunes, rate, review, leave comments. That helps us in some way that I don't fully understand because we've never had enough of them in a short enough time really for it to affect us, yeah. I think.
So next week, to continue the bestseller train, even though this book came out like 6 years ago, it has recently reclimbed the bestseller list thanks to the Brad Pitt movie. We were talking about World War Z by Max Brooks. And if you've already seen the movie, don't worry about it, because apparently it has nothing to do with the book.
Yeah, and this is a bestseller that has the additional benefit of both of us having wanted to read it for probably about 6 years.
Yeah. I was just going to read it anyway, so right. I was pretty excited to find it was on the bestseller list.
So I think that is everything.
Yeah.
And we will see you next time.
Bye.